The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Avery Lewis from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence and Ebony magazines. The first article is called Birthright, Tatiana Ali's heartfelt essay on the importance and beauty of Black women's pregnancy journey. Now that the Black mortality rate has come to the attention of lawmakers and even some presidential candidates and made headline news, the public is increasingly aware that the rates for Black women are 3 and 4 times higher than they are for white women. Yet U.S. media have pathologicalized the story as though Black women, Black families, and Black bodies are to blame. Some Black women I've spoken with are now scared to get pregnant, as if there is something broken in us, because our lives are often framed in a culture of poverty narrative. I fear that we have internalized the problem and made ourselves the cause when the truth is we are being treated unfairly, disrespectfully, at worst criminally, or not treated at all. The recently published study, Giving Voice to Mothers, found that mistreatment is experienced more frequently by women of color when birth occurs in hospitals and among those with social, economic, or health challenges. In addition, patriarchy has shrouded birth in mystery. Start asking the mothers you know about their experiences. It's stunning how little we share with one another. We are so used to questioning our intuition and the strength and beauty of our bodies, not just in appearance, but also in function. We internalize other people's gestures and comments, even more so when those people are healthcare professionals. Now, I'm fairly used to being a Black woman in this world. I put on the necessary psychological armor when I leave my home. But who has time for all of that when they are in labor? The birth of my first son 3 years ago went completely off script. For some reasons that I have come to know are pretty much textbook, my low-risk pregnancy resulted in extremely questionable actions on the part of those attending and an emergency C-section. My labor was horrid, filled with people I didn't know screaming at me. My doula, concerned with her status at the hospital, who knew I wanted a natural birth, persistently advised me to take an epidural. I agreed, and the epidural left me unable to move. One doctor slammed his forearm on top of my belly in order to force my son down, as though I were a tube of toothpaste. My delivery room had become a circus. There were people everywhere, but no one to help me deliver. After the suction cup on my baby's head failed repeatedly, I feared for her safety and finally asked for a C-section. By the time they rolled me into the OR, I had passed out completely from the trauma of the Savinelli maneuver. My husband, advocating for our baby and me the entire time, was as traumatized as I was. Postpartum, I was told by someone in the hospital that I had a pelvis shaped like a man's. I now know that comment was cruel and ridiculous. The worst part of our trial was that our son spent several days in the NICU as a result of his harrowing birth. We spent our first year of parenthood loving our baby, each other as fiercely as we knew how. knowing that healing our physical and psychic wounds was essential for the health of our marriage and future of our new family. Somehow, we had to unravel the paradoxical feelings of blissed out love for our beautiful boy and anger and degradation of knowing that we put ourselves in the hands of people who had no inclination to honor our preferences. And there were intense feelings of guilt that I still wrestle with. I secretly wished for a natural birth in a birth center, but the fears of those closest to me won out over honoring my intuition. I believe that my choice to birth naturally in a hospital was misguided and led to the inpatience and interventions that ultimately put my baby's health in jeopardy. When we decided to grow our family, I began to search for a better way. I had just found out that I was pregnant with our second child when I was asked to participate in the Black Mamas Matter Alliance 2018 Black Maternal Health Week. BMMA is a coalition of Black women committed to reducing the United States Black maternal mortality and morbidity rates and improving outcomes overall during the prenatal, perinatal, and postpartum periods. Healing the generational wounds and spiritual amnesia imposed by a medical industry that has historically misled, abused, and degraded Black women is not work that can be done alone. Wondering if others felt like me, I had shared my breastfeeding experience on Instagram earlier that year. As a result of those posts, I found myself in the presence of 300 or so midwives, doulas, and reproductive justice activists, leaders in a grassroots movement to reclaim women's rights to determine how and where we birth our babies and to ensure that all Black women have access to those choices. There is a rich history of Black and indigenous midwifery and doula care currently being resuscitated both as a means of improving outcomes for Black and brown women and lowering the high rates of maternal and infant deaths. Some lineages remain unbroken and their traditions and practices are proliferating. More than an alternative to the hospital system, traditional midwifery, its practitioners, ethos, and practices should be an integral part of the maternal health care system. That idea is a major component of the work being done by coalitions of women from organizations and think tanks like Black Mamas Matter Alliance, Sister Song, Black Women Birthing Justice, and the Birthplace Lab, to name just a few. Some progressive hospitals are beginning to support midwifery as a valuable modality, but MD envisions a future with more choice. As a Black mother who is an OBGYN, I truly understand why families desire to give birth outside of hospitals. Instead of demonizing people, we should take an honest look at what we are doing that makes people feel not valued and safe. Historically, Black midwives did much more than catch babies. They were highly valued members of their communities who provided perinatal, and postpartum support and advocated for the families they served. Their work is oftentimes intersectional and inclusive of the LGBTQ communities, in addition to parents with special needs who remain at risk of mishandling and neglect. In addition to providing exceptional care, midwives protect and advocate for their clients. For example, Frequently, hospital staff collaborate with Child Protective Services in an effort to monitor minority and low-income mothers. Too often, the result of these efforts is the tragic disruption of families. Some midwives with experience in this dynamic try to anticipate the encroachments of hospitals and agencies and work tirelessly to protect their clients. Midwife Racha Lawler, CPM LM, explains, Black home birth midwives must provide prenatal care with blood work, nutritional counseling, and where the building of trust begins, by providing clients with all their options and supporting them in these options. In the event that we must go to the hospital, we must be professional in navigating the systemic racism, policies, and possibly unsupportive staff to keep the client family informed, supported, and oftentimes protected in birthing. One Baltimore midwife I spent time with, Chaplain Asma Hanif, CNM, established All Nisa Health Center to provide free, culturally sensitive maternal care to women in general and specifically to women of the Muslim faith. Many of the women who come to her seeking shelter and maternity care are fleeing abusive homes. Some have recently immigrated and would be unable to find care elsewhere. After being educated in this new paradigm, I felt deeply in my heart that midwifery care in the Black birthing tradition and a VBAC birth in my own home would be the best choice for me and my family this time around. Previously, my husband and I took classes that made birth seem like, at best, a medical procedure, and at worst, a battle royal. This time, I feel that I am actually preparing for motherhood. This time, we are preparing for a rite that speaks to the psychologist, to the psychological, physical, and spiritual transformation that will take place. This time, instead of planning for a medical procedure, I am planning for the birth of my baby and my birth as a mother. My midwife is a Black woman. She spent hours with me and my family as though I am her only patient. She asks how I feel and what our hopes are. She conducts herself in a way that is culturally and spiritually attuned to me, and she trusts in our ability to make informed decisions. She asks permission to touch my belly at every appointment and has encouraged me to honor my intuition. We have made plans with her for every eventuality. As a primary healthcare provider, she has made appointments for ultrasounds and gone over the results with me, taken blood, and provided information regarding vaccinations and genetic tests. And to that respect, emotional support, postpartum home visits, love, guidance, and always the awesome power of choice. Both my husband and I, even our toddler, are giddy with anticipation. Simply put, I am empowered. I choose sugarcane as the backdrop for my maternity shot because it signifies reclamation. It is the crop that my ancestors from India to Trinidad on my father's side and from Ghana to Benin to Panama on my mother's side cultivated before coming here to the United States. They built the wealth of the modern world in their blood. Resilience and dignity are my children's inheritance. I will keep it safe. Shortly after writing this essay, Tatiana and her husband, Vaughn Raspberry, welcomed baby boy Alejandro Vaughn Raspberry. The next article today is titled, Nakia Hammonds, Blakely, Survived Breast Cancer by Advocating for Herself. In April 1994, when Nakia Hammonds Blakely was 16, she felt a lump in her breast during a morning shower. A family doctor performed a biopsy, assuring her that it was probably nothing serious. But despite having no family history of breast cancer, Hammonds Blakely soon learned she had a rare and aggressive form of her condition. After undergoing painful radiation treatment and a partial mastectomy, she beat it, but her life was forever changed. The trauma of balling up gym socks to get that symmetry right was really hard, Hammonds Blakely says of adjusting to her uneven breast. I'll never forget those moments. 18 cancer-free years later, the Frisco, Texas resident was told at her annual mammogram that even though the images of her tissue looked suspicious, there was probably nothing to fear. She insisted on further testing. It turned out to be breast cancer in the opposite breast, she recalls. It never would have been caught had I not championed my own care. Today, at 41, Hammonds Blakely is a spokeswoman for the Know Your Girls campaign, a national effort by the Susan G. Komen Organization and the Ad Council to inform Black women about early detection and self-advocacy. You have to know you're normal and be able to say something's not right. With the help of Know Your Girls, Nakia hopes to serve, save, and empower other Black women. I want my legacy to be that I use my voice. That's what I knew I shared, and that somebody else was a little better off because of it. Tracee Ellis Ross was never booked on a late night show while starring in Girlfriends. Despite the success of the hit TV series Girlfriends back in the day, Tracee Ellis Ross wasn't always getting invited to be part of Hollywood's inner circle as she is today. Essence October cover star opened up about never being invited to late night talk shows or even award shows during the height of her run on the series, which went off the air in 2008 after 6 seasons. When I was on Girlfriends, I couldn't even get on a late night show. No joke, I was never on any of those episodes, the Blackish star told Julie Wilson, Essence Global Beauty Director, on the latest episode of the Color Files podcast. And I remember the talent agent at one of those late night talk shows said, "Call us when Tracee gets something. She's amazing. We love her. Call us when she gets something." I was on Girlfriends. I was the lead. It was a huge hit in our community, and we had a lot of eyeballs. She continued, "But I'd never gone to the Golden Globes. I'd never gone to the Emmys. I'd never gone to any of those award shows. All of that has happened since I got on Blackish in my mid-40s. None of that was part of my experience in the early part of my career. Girlfriends, the Mara Brock Akil hit comedy, not only became a fan favorite, it spawned a successful spinoff, The Game, which ran for 9 seasons on BET. Once the show concluded, Ross said she expected more movie roles to land in her lap, but that never happened. The disappointment, she said, was a blessing in many ways because it forced her to become comfortable with where she was in her career in life. Promotional portrait of the cast of the UPN television series Girlfriends, Los Angeles, California, January 5th, 2004, left to right American actresses Jill Marie Jones, Persia White, Tracee Ellis Ross, and Golden Brooks. It forced my soul to continue to search for what it longed for, dreamt of, wanted to be. She explained, it allowed me to continue an unbreakable, unshakable foundation for my life, a relationship with myself that was based not on what everybody outside is saying, but was about what I believe was good and right. It allowed me to continue to grow as a person and realize what it is that I wanted from my life, what it is that I wanted to share, what I had to offer, that I was enough, that I really felt that I was deserving and worthy of many things in my career. Ross said that stalling of walking into Hollywood's inner circle allowed her own success. But I could also own what might look like failure, she continued. I could just be with me. I could literally be my own best friend and mirror my worth is not tangled up in what even I think I should be getting. And now Ross gets to combine the two shows that have been major breakthroughs in her career on one episode. The next article that I'll be reading is entitled WizKid Kicks Off Nigerian Independence Day with new song entitled Joro. Nigerian superstar WizKid dropped some fresh new music just in time for Nigerian Independence Day. His new tune, Joro, which dropped with an accompanying video, comes after the viral success of his collaboration with Beyonce on Brown Skin Girl from her The Lion King, The Gift. And Joro is landing as Nigerians worldwide celebrate their independence from British rule in 1963. Last July, WizKid had initially hinted he would drop Joro, but instead decided to go with his single, Ghetto Love, from his fourth studio project, Made in Lagos, that is set for release this winter. Earlier this summer, he also made history on Spotify as the first African artist to reach 8 million monthly listeners on the streaming platform. He plans to bring his Starboy Fest back to the O2 area in London on October 19th. Check out the vibey video for Joro. Maxine Waters says Trump should be in prison and placed in solitary confinement. Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat, California, who has always been vocal about what she thinks of President Donald Trump, is now saying that impeachment is too good for the controversial president and has upped the ante, calling for Trump to be in prison and placed in solitary confinement. I'm calling on the GOP to stop Trump's filthy talk of whistleblowers being spies and using mob language implying they should be killed. Impeachment is not good enough for Trump, Waters tweeted on Tuesday afternoon. He needs to be imprisoned and placed in solitary confinement, but for now, impeachment is imperative. Waters has been in opposition of the president, not mincing words with what she views as his corrupt ways. She was the first member of Congress to call for Trump's impeachment from the very beginning and always made it clear that she neither respects or trusts 45. This is also not the first time she suggested that the president should be imprisoned. Trump wasn't the only one to face Waters' scathing criticism on Tuesday, with the congresswoman also calling out U.S. Attorney General William Barr. Attorney General Barr is the highest law enforcement officer and the worst. He's supposed to be the people's lawyer, but he's just Trump's puppet, she continued. He's been caught soliciting foreign countries' help in undermining his FBI and our intel agencies. He should be Trump's companion with impeachment. Mazzani's new global campaign is a love letter to all black hair textures. If there's one thing we've learned from a black lady sketch show, is that when a project is created, led and executed by an all black woman team, the result is magical. And of course, the melanin is popping. Mazzani's newest global campaign is a testament to both. Created and executed entirely by women of color, with three black women at the helm, it's dripping with black excellence and, of course, the magnificence of black beauty. We believe it was time to refresh the look and feel of our beloved brand Mazzani. From the models' hair looks to our new vivid color palette and fresh tone of voice, the content we produce today is reflective of what resonates most with her, said Tumi Soyinka, Assistant Vice President of Marketing Worldwide for Mazzani. The heart of Mazzani is to empower our users to stay true to their authenticity and to champion the unlimited possibilities that the beautiful fabric of our textured hair lives for. So whether she wants a wig, sleek it, braid it, twist it, or wash and go it, the point is Mazzani's got it. The campaign is a relaunching for Mazzani with new branding and new vision. Creative director Pekilia Riley and famed photographer Itasha Jordan brought their unique perspectives and skills together along with Soyinka to bring new vision to life. Designed and ingrained in inclusivity, it's clear from the beautiful visuals that the campaign is meant to empower women, no matter what hair texture they choose to wear, no matter what hair goals they have. Unlike the drama and extravagance of past collections, my expression in this body of work was to honor and reflect the relatable and yet magically intriguing visual aspects of women we know and love in our daily lives, said Pekilia Rowling. It's to declare our presence in every tone and texture, celebrate classics and culture, and most emphatically, being enough without the overtop elements and even sometimes disconnecting grandeur. I desire that the conversation around black hair be about health and condition versus length or the constant assertion of victimizing or non-acceptance paradigms of texture types. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Ebony. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Call 919-832-5138 with questions. Thank you.